This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, shares of Tesla trading lower today, down 4.9% on the latest drop of negative news, including a Bloomberg exclusive about two of Tesla's top executives leaving in the midst of the company's latest rounds of job cuts. That's according to people familiar with the matter.
That's right, Tim. And the other news is about Tesla moving to slash headcount by 10%. And then, of course, there are the bigger, broader metrics to consider for Tesla and really everybody in the EV space. And they are an overall slowing EV uptick and growing global competition.
With all things Tesla, back with us is Bloomberg News, Bloomberg Television co-host of Bloomberg Technology, Ed Ludlow in our San Francisco bureau. Ed, I was commenting on our editorial call this morning. Oftentimes when you see a company, you hear news of a company making wide-scale layoffs, such as cutting 10% of its staff. Oftentimes investors react positively to that news, but not so in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, the stock is down almost 5%. And, you know, I think that this is just a situation where the initial news of, and by the way, the language Elon Musk used is more than 10%, which I'll get to in a second. But I think it's just more evidence that things are quite hard at the moment for Tesla. There's a lot that's happened in quick succession. We only just got first quarter deliveries that were 62,000 units below what the street was expecting. And the reason I say that, that Elon's language in a memo he sent to staff is important, he said more than 10,000. Actually, what I'm hearing in the last couple of hours is that many teams across Tesla saw cuts much closer to 20%, you know, much deeper cutting in specific teams. So I think we still need a bit of a sense of how deep this is, but I think it's quite severe given Tesla's scale.
Well, it is always too, right, knowing the specifics, right, the specificity. I mean, this is a company that employs, according to our Bloomberg metrics, more than 140,000 people. So they employ a lot of people. But we want to
Until last night.
Last night, exactly. But we want to know, as you said, in different teams, you want to know which teams, right, and maybe what it says about the strategy of the company. And then I want to roll on top of it this exclusive that you and Dana Hull have on about two senior executives. I always get a little concerned about when members of the senior executive start to leave a company and maybe what it means. So roll it all together and maybe what we know more specifically about what's going on inside at Tesla.
In the first instance, what I'm hearing is that actually roles relating to AI, particularly Autopilot and Optimus, the humanoid robot, have been less impacted by this. The story you're referring to is that Drew Baglino, who was until last night the senior vice president of powertrain and energy, he ran anything that was related to batteries, both cars and storage-wise. He has left Tesla. And what we reported in the first instance is that actually he'd resigned. He was not part of the layoffs, but that he had left of his own volition. And he went out on social media a few hours after we broke that story and confirmed the report. But it's really important. I would consider it a sort of the latest in an exodus of intellectual capital. Drew has been at Tesla for 18 years, and he had a massive portfolio of responsibility. And he was one of just four named executive officers, the others being Tom Zhu, who came over from China to kind of lead operations. Elon Musk is one, and then you have the CFO. So if they only have four people in the C-suite, they've just lost one, and that's quite a big deal.
And this on the heels of Zach Kirkhorn leaving Tesla, the longtime CFO, just last year. So the exodus Sort of continuing there, Ed. I mean, there have been many waves of exoduses at Tesla over the lifetime of the company. Is this one any different?
This one is really hard to gauge. I mean, again, what I was told by sources is that categorically this was Drew resigning and leaving. And in his post on X, he basically said that the time had come. He's been very busy. I can tell you that Drew Baglino has a young family. He was spending a lot of time at Tesla. And people have their reasons. The timing's very curious, because it was the same day that Tesla announced mass layoffs. And he wasn't isolated. Rohan Patel, who is basically Tesla's global public policy chief, their lobbyist in chief, if you like, also left the company yesterday of his own volition. And, you know, it seems to be like this is Tesla leaving one phase of its company life and entering into another one. But one thing I would say, I also hear a lot of positive things, you know, that actually Tesla is really strong on the battery and energy side of the business. It's growing really well. A lot of the projects that Drew was leading, I'm told, are going very smoothly. And so I, you know, one reason for him leaving is that he just didn't feel obligated anymore to stick around.
Yeah, I get that, right? Any kind of company that's an innovator, a disruptor, a technology company, right? Like, as you said so well, they go through phases. And if you think about the battery side of the business, it sounds like they've got this kind of down, right? And so if that was the individual leading it, maybe he's looking for new challenges or what have you. So I kind of get it. I don't know. I am also curious in terms of internally what the mood is at Tesla, because there's a lot going on, Ed. Like, I feel like almost every week, easily, there's a lot of stories we talk to you about when it comes to Tesla.
You know, it's never pleasant reporting on layoffs in any technology company. You know, you're talking about people losing their jobs. And one of the things I'm looking into now is the sort of level of severance that Tesla may or may not be paying and things like that. How it works mechanically is that there was a big rumor mill. It started on Friday. You guys probably remember Dana and I broke the story about a month ago that there were these performance reviews and that the performance reviews have been delayed so that the decisions could be made on people that didn't make the cut. So since then, people have been kind of braced that more layoffs might be coming, and they did. And how it works is Elon sends an email to the entire global workforce, and that's exactly how it played out this time, just like last time. And then you wait to see if you got an email to tell you you're impacted. And so now, you know, internally, there's a bit of relief because many of the people who were impacted have found out that that's the case in the last few hours, if not last night.
Hey, Ed, give us an idea of Elon Musk's commitment to Tesla right now, given that, as you and Dana remind everyone in your piece, he's the head of six other companies simultaneously.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So to recap, Elon Musk is the CEO of Tesla. He's also the CEO of SpaceX. He has an official role with xAI. He is the CEO of X, the platform and company formerly known as Twitter. He also has Boring Co., the tunnel-making company. And then he has Neuralink. And I guess how committed or not Elon is to Tesla in the context of today's news, don't know the answer, frankly. I would make the observation, well, Elon's still there, even if everyone else isn't. You know, the executives have come and gone, and Elon's still the one there that's breaking the news about the layoffs to his staff. But Drew Baglino leaving, and again, I go back to the idea that he was one of just four named executives. You know, you guys have so many CEOs on the show, but you also know that many companies have a very large C-suite, even if the CEO is the head honcho. Tesla was never like that. It's always had a very concentrated power center in Elon and then maybe one or two others. And so we at least can now say that Drew Baglino will not be the next CEO of Tesla if indeed Musk ever decided that he didn't want to be the CEO anymore or the board made that decision. And that's where we stand. But succession is a big question that Wall Street in particular has. Whether Tesla fans or owners do, it's probably not as clear.
You know, when it comes to just kind of some of the changes that are going on at Tesla or the more than 10% job cuts that are happening, it's also kind of what's going on more broadly, right, in the EV space. And I do wonder how much of it, we've seen other moves at other EV makers, certainly here in the United States, of cutting back, right, and changing their strategy. So how much of it is that kind of a reset, Ed, of, all right, here's the current market environment, we've got to rethink this?
So Tesla's first quarter deliveries were not good. Right. They were 62,000 units below street consensus. It was almost a drop year on year, which is kind of, it hasn't happened to Tesla for a long time. They've been on this growth trajectory. I actually have some specifics about these deeper cuts that sources basically explained to me. After the tough start to the year, Elon went to each of the leadership, people in leadership at Tesla, the different business units, and said, I am giving you very aggressive goals for cost cutting, and you have a remit and a license to reach those goals in any way that you need to. And so what I'm hearing is that those teams and divisions where the job cuts are closer to 20% rather than the more than 10% Elon put in his email are those where the leaders said, okay, Elon, you told us to be aggressive. We will be aggressive. But they were given license to do so. And what's so interesting is you guys, we've talked so much about prices of Tesla cars,
right,
how they go up and they go down in particular. But you forget that actually Elon Musk has paid attention to cost discipline for a really long time. Mm-hmm. He has this ethos of shave as many cents off each component as you can. And that's playing out now.
All right. Great stuff as always. Ed, thank you so much. Ed Ludlow, co-host of Bloomberg Technology on Bloomberg Television, joining us from our San Francisco bureau. Shares of Tesla, Tim, down about 5% in today's session, and they're down about 34% so far this year.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
The other thing that really set the tone right out of the gate, it feels like, this morning, although the tone has changed a little bit, and that is the U.S. retail sales report, rising by more than forecast in the month of March. And then you had the month, the prior month also revised upward. Bottom line, we know this, Tim, you and I have been talking about this, U.S. consumers are out there shopping, and that is largely continuing to fuel economic growth here in the U.S. economy.
And yet, as our next guest will share, what consumers have in their wallet is actually what's giving them the most stress. Here to explain is Katie Thomas, lead of the Kearney Consumer Institute, with us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Katie, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I want to talk about this morning's data that we got, because that's certainly setting the tone for a lot of what we're seeing, at least when it comes to yields today. Is that not necessarily matching up with the stresses that you're finding at the Kearney Consumer Institute?
Oh, no, actually, Tim, I think it matches up perfectly, which is, even though there's still some stress on the consumer wallet, what we heard from consumers in the U.S. is that their stress went down slightly. And so I think you're seeing that reflected in these retail numbers. And so the way our index is structured is twofold. One is to capture what we call sensitivity. So that's the voiced stress. And that is still there, right? We all still feel stressed. It's like you feel tired, you feel busy, you feel stressed. But in order to mitigate that, we have what we call our flexibility metric. And that's more the optionality consumers have, the agency they have, the ability to impact. And what we found is that more objective metric helps to really mitigate some of that vocalized stress, which is why we're seeing exactly what we were hoping to prove out with our index, which is that consumers are still spending, even though we kind of feel stressed. It really shows both sides of that coin.
Hey, what are they spending on, though? Because the retail sales report that we got this morning, Katie, said that maybe U.S. consumers are less reluctant to spend on big ticket items. So break it down for us and what you guys are seeing and hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we're digging into as a result of our indexes is discretionary spend and needs versus wants. The hard part about that is sometimes it's not doesn't fit as neatly into categories as we would like it to be. So how people think about what's a need versus a want, you know, take a new pair of shoes. Sounds discretionary, but if you have a growing kid, that may be more of a need. Even something like a vacation feels very discretionary, but if you know your beach vacation, maybe that must have that you have to have year over year. So that is a lot of what we're still seeing, which is that sort of experience and then the things that come along with it. So I want to take vacation. I want to go out to eat. I still want to go out and enjoy time with family and friends. And then there's things that come along with it, depending on your interest of choice. But you know, we've seen a tapering in some of those pandemic stock up areas such as home decor, even beauty at times. A lot of us got very influenced during the pandemic. Now maybe we have a full makeup drawer.
So Katie, at this point, are consumers used to, I'm not going to say inflation because there were so many years where inflation was an afterthought, at least for American consumers, but are they used to going to the grocery store and seeing that what they're paying for groceries is significantly more than they paid in, let's say, March of 2020?
I mean, yes and no. Again, if you talk to people, they will very much voice that they are so upset that prices keep going up, but they are coping. And that's one of the other things I love about Index is, you know, consumers aren't passive. They're very savvy, they're thoughtful, and they're making conscious trade-offs. So when you think of something like food inflation, they're feeling the impact of it, but they're figuring out how to navigate through it. So they're shopping different stores, different brands. Maybe they're figuring out areas that they can cut. And they're just really deciding what matters and what they want to prioritize. But I think, you know, it still is a bit top of mind that the inflation numbers still tends to weigh on people.
You guys look at consumers on a global basis. And, you know, it's interesting, of course, we look at economies around the world and try to figure out kind of where, certainly for investors, which economies seem to stand out. And the U.S. economy continues to stand out. But give us that global picture, Katie, if you will, in terms of what you are seeing.
Yeah, I mean, not only was this work done in 12 countries, but geopolitics and government is one of the pillars that we looked at here. And that is, we talked about that sensitivity metric. That is what's most top of mind for many countries all around the world. It's something that's really weighing on people, whether it's, you know, global conflicts in various countries around the world, but also political polarization. That's certainly not just a U.S. problem. Now, the good news is, surprisingly, 60 countries have, not surprisingly, I guess, 60 countries have elections coming up this year. So that's where we're seeing some of those flexibility numbers improve. People know they can vote. And whether they love their choices or not, they're feeling like they have more of the agency and impact. And so as we think about global economies, I'm certainly tracking who's voting this year and how can that bubble up to other consumer behavior.
Katie, I know the Institute hasn't been able to take this into account because it just happened over the weekend. But we see something like, you know, Iran firing drones and missiles at Israel, for example, and certain potentially stress associated with geopolitics. Is that reflected in consumer spending at all?
You know, it tends to be, you know, interesting blips. So we see occasionally, like, there may be a slowdown. If there's something major happening, like when things first started happening in Palestine, there was in Ukraine, there was a slowdown for a day or two in certain demographics that maybe were just glued to the news. So there are things that we see there, but it is very sort of reactionary to the media. So it's a little bit hard to predict and plan for, but there is an impact.
What was surprising in the results as you guys did this latest update?
Yeah, so I think the most surprising for me was actually that we saw a growth in stress around innovation and technology. And so some of what we've seen in the index overall certainly has to do with sort of what's in the media cycle, right? You think about housing prices, food inflation, et cetera. And I think as those things have no longer been the newest news, we've seen more about AI and technology. And you're hearing consumers voice concerns over that. So it may be data privacy, it may be AI. You know, just the other day, I saw a story on TikTok where someone said they had their annual physical denied by their insurance, and it turned out an AI had evaluated the claim. And so that's where, as we talk to clients and businesses, we're saying, be very thoughtful about the way you're introducing AI and how that's being communicated to consumers and interacting with consumers in that facing way, because there's a lot to learn there and there's already some stress over it.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Katie, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Katie Thomas, lead at the Kearney Consumer Institute, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on this Monday.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder.
That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, we love talking shipping and logistics. After all, understanding who's shipping where and how much they're shipping is key to understanding trade and the global economy. Our next guest has a great read into that. Greg Hewitt is CEO at DHL Express US. It's a segment of Deutsche Post DHL Group, one of the biggest private employers in the world. They've got more than 550,000 employees, revenues of more than $87 billion just last year. Greg's here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
So great to have you here. We do. Tim and I love talking to anybody and everybody who is involved in transportation because it does feel like you guys do have some great insight into what's going on in the economy. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for the invite. My pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the environment and what you're seeing and the level of activity and how it compares from the last 6 months from 12 months. I mean, I'm not quite sure with the pandemic still, if we're still thinking about pre-pandemic levels, but what are you seeing?
I think I've seen to start the year, we felt it was going to maybe be a little bit stronger, a little bit more growth. We're coming off of post-pandemic, a bit of a downturn. What we saw was e-commerce was kind of fueling any growth. The traditional segments, automotive, engineering and manufacturing, high tech, were still a little bit lower, maybe having last year a little bit too much inventory, trying to cycle that out. We went into the year with optimism, thinking we closed last year stronger, maybe it was going to grow. Haven't quite seen that in first quarter, seeing it a little bit softer than we thought, but everybody's optimistic. A lot of people are talking about peak season this year, which in air and ocean will come in the summer. For me, in express, it'll come kind of U.S. Thanksgiving to end of year.
Yeah.
People are optimistic that volume will grow and things are recovering.
Okay, you mentioned air and ocean, so I want to just start with ocean. Are you seeing any increase, or is DHL seeing any increase in demand from the ships that are avoiding the Suez Canal? How's that playing out for you?
I think a little less than I thought, quite honest.
Really?
In my segment, usually when there are pinch points in any one of the sectors, like in the ocean transport, maybe people move things over to a fixed network like ours and Express. I haven't really seen that lift yet. I think companies are still being patient. They still have time before the peak to allow things to work themselves through. Where we'll probably see it would be more towards the summer, or for me, fall season. If there continues to be challenges with the supply chain, that's when things start to convert over to air and we'd see a lift in cargo.
Greg, what's the most challenging part of your business right now? I mean, certainly something we talk about is higher energy prices, right? And we've pulled back a little bit off of kind of the activity over the weekend in the Middle East, but I am curious if that's starting to bite into some of your costs or raise that cost equation.
From my perspective, still my biggest challenge is dealing with the inflationary pressures that go with rising wage rates here in the U.S. and the need to compensate my team who are skilled workers to keep the front lines happy. That's probably still my biggest versus anything globally that's putting pressure on.
That's interesting to hear. Where is that pinch point the biggest? Is that with people in warehouses, people actually doing the driving, doing the deliveries?
Exactly.
You're not talking back office folks.
No, it would be more frontline, finding the skilled labor for couriers and terminal handling staff.
I mean, who's your competition there? Is it Amazon around the country that's just driving up wages?
I don't know if I would say that it's anybody that's driving it up. I think in general, you've heard coming through the pandemic, every wages, whether it was at a Dunkin' Donuts to a courier, everything goes up.
We talk about California's minimum wage all the time, up to $20 an hour at this point.
And we have to respond to that and make sure that anywhere where we're employing people, not only are we at the minimum wage, but generally because it's skilled labor, we've got to be a bit above that.
Well, one thing, you know, and this is something we talk about when we focus a lot on inflation generally here in the United States, and we were having a conversation earlier with one of our analysts who watches the rate environment, and this kind of debate about whether or not this idea of the Fed getting back to 2% inflation, whether it makes sense anymore, because there does seem like the workforce, that there's just not enough workers that people need, and that maybe a higher wage is something not just short term or until the next wage cycle, but something longer built into kind of our economic model. Do you agree with that, or what's your thinking about wages longer term?
I think from my standpoint, what I'm not seeing is wages don't go down. Once they go up, they tend to hold and grow from that. What we've seen is lower levels of turnover, so we've got stability in the workforce that have gone with the higher wages. So I think that's a good thing. Now we've got to drive productivity in order to make sure that we've got this shareholder return.
So, Carol, this was Carol's idea. She's like, we got to talk drones here. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well,
if... How you make them more productive.
I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, if the folks on the front lines are the ones who are driving up wages, I'm wondering how DHL is experimenting with drones, drone delivery, and if that is actually something that's realistic in terms of supplanting or replacing at any point certain humans who are doing the delivering.
From my perspective, it hasn't. It's not going to supplant humans doing the delivery. In fact, I don't see it. I think the reality is there are challenges around having autonomous vehicles in the air and airspace. We have used it in some remote locations to deliver medicine and such. I think we're still going to need people delivering packages, but with the advantage of automation in terms of software that helps with routing, helps make sure they can be efficient and effective. Those are the things that I see in the near term as more of an impact.
Got to say, and forgive me, I'm going to talk about the competition, but UPS, one of the things after spending, this was a few years back, but spending a day with a delivery man. I mean, it's all technology. And this whole idea of a kidded with these, with our team, you don't make left turns, you make right turns because you don't want a truck or driver spending seconds, minutes at an intersection. So things like this do add up.
They absolutely do. And so our biggest investments in technology in the last few years would be around routing software and station optimization. And now with international,
station optimization
would be what's the optimal amount of courier routes and personnel that you'd have in a station based on big data, the data that tells you what's coming in, how do you allocate that most effectively, and put into that with global trade clearance, customs clearance. That's probably the next area we're investing heavily in, because we need to do that more efficiently, more effectively, more streamlined.
Well, can I ask you what happens there? Is it just takes long?
If you have to clear something formally, you've got an entry writer who has to go through the harmonized tax codes, making sure all of the information is available for customs to clear it effectively and for the duties and taxes to be assigned. It can be a bit of a manual process. So doing things with automation that makes it more accurate, more efficient, more effective as part of our customs clearance experience.
How's air capacity looking at the company right now? Do you have too much air capacity?
I wouldn't say we have too much. I think we probably adjusted coming out of COVID, where we had a lot of charters and extra capacity that balanced out our fixed network, the jets that we've bought. We've now right-sized those. We try to run 80 to 90% capacity utilization and then scale accordingly. And we're running at good levels.
Well, to what extent are you leaning more on third-party capacity providers right now?
I think if I would have said before the pandemic, we were very balanced between our own network and leveraging commercial lift. Through the pandemic, we leaned much heavier on our own network. Now we're probably balancing it out. Before we add maybe another jet into our own fleet, we will look at commercial to balance it out.
So when we started, Greg, it sounded like there was hope that things get a little bit better this year. Do any of your clients talking about slowdown, recession?
Not really. In fact, I would say compared to this time last year, where there was a lot of uneasiness, where inventory levels were high, and there was a lot of uncertainty, this year when I talk to them, they are optimistic. What I haven't seen is the orders flow through and the moves go through yet. But people
like
are feeling.
I like what you're saying, but show me the order.
We want to see them, but it gives me optimism that for peak season, we'll see a return to more of the norm. We're usually in third and fourth quarter, there's a rise in goods moving that we haven't seen in the last couple of years to the same extent.
Why would a customer go with DHL instead of going with FedEx or UPS?
Well, for me, our DNA and what we were born out of in 1969 is international. And our specialty is around the movement of goods internationally. So if you're a small business or a business bringing goods in from around the world, Nobody can clear it and deliver it like we do. If you're a business that looks to market your goods globally, nobody knows those countries and consumers better than us.
Greg, 20 seconds left here, because you do see kind of the trade, if you will, going between the U.S. and globally. Any pushback that you see in terms of the globalization idea that we keep hearing in narratives? Just quickly.
Yeah, we definitely have heard concern, a little more protectionist policy in a number of places.
Do you see it, though, in the data?
I haven't seen in the day-to-day. What I have seen is probably the U.S.-China relationship. Definitely China plus one, new markets in Asia and Mexico growing because of that.
Yeah, we hear that a lot.
We love talking shipping and logistics.
I told you, we really like it. Greg Hewitt, Chief Executive Officer, U.S. of DHL Express here in studio. Greg, thank you.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session on this Monday. Let's get to it, our drive to the close. And our next guest, still a bull, still overweight with U.S. stocks, Ryan Dietrich is in the house, Chief Market Strategist over at the Carson Group, joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, too, is our own Bill Maloney, who you just heard live on air, watching the technical analyst here at Bloomberg. And before I bring you in, Ryan, because I know you watch it, I got to go give you props, Bill, because you talked about the 50-day moving average big time on Friday.
And it held the 50-day moving average
going
on
into
Friday.
The weekend. Yeah.
Exactly, going into the weekend. And today there was no support, sliced right through it.
So here we are to the death. Well, what does it mean? So what does it mean, Ryan? You are bullish, have had a bullish outlook. What do you say to that in terms of breaking that?
Sure. Near term, it's a potential. First off, thanks for having me back. And
you're
thanks
welcome.
For the good weather in your city today.
You're
it's awesome
very welcome.
Walking around out there. But yeah, it's a little near term concern. But I mean, the big picture to us, and we've talked about these before, but up 30% the last 12 months, up 5 months in a row, up 27%, 100 trading days off that October low, late October low. To see some type of indigestion, some type of pullback is not that surprising. I think, you know, a little bit further lower is a 200-day. That's kind of where we'd expect to see, you know, more support. But all in all, it's not that abnormal, I think, to have some of this give back after the run we've had.
I mean, up 6% still on the S&P 500 so far this year. How much of a give back, Ryan, could we have?
Yeah, I mean, we started off the year, as we know, we started off the year up about 10% in the first quarter or so. I mean, between 5 to 8% would be perfectly normal. I mean, this year, I know today's going to be different, but before today, 2.5% is the max peak to trough correction we saw all year. That would tie 95 for the least ever, and then 2017's in there about 3.5%. So to think we're going to go into an election year when there is usually a little more volatility without more than a 2.5% correction would be foolish, I think. And the fact that it's happening isn't overly concerning to us right now. I mean, look at the news, right? I mean, consumer is still strong. We get into some of those things. But from a technical point of view, we still think that this market is fairly strong. It's just due for some correction. One more final thing. When you gain 10% the first quarter, normally the rest of the year continues to do well. Here's what's interesting. The last time it was an election year that gained at least 10% the first quarter was in 2012. The rest of the year only gained 2% back then. So I think we're getting a little more, but election years, maybe you can have some chopped rest of the year as we go into that election.
Bill Maloney, we've got a bull in the house. I mean, when you listen to him, and I'm curious because you're also talking to a lot of traders and so on and so forth as the market moves, are you hearing more bearish sentiment or bullish sentiment out there?
Not really. I think Ryan's exactly right, is we've had such a big move. Well, we've had such a big move from the October lows. We have to digest some of it. Trading below the 50-day, okay, we're below the 50-day, and there may be something down at 5,000, so maybe next support around 5,000, which is only 60 points away. So not a big deal at this point.
Well, Bill, how do geopolitics change the equation, or could they change the equation if we do see something more widespread in the Middle East?
From a trading standpoint, definitely changes the perspective. I mean, you're seeing today just the Twitter sphere was lighting up about a potential Israeli response. That's why we're selling off today. So right now the market is probably a slave to what's going on in the Middle East.
And I'll chime in on that. I mean, absolutely, in the near term. At the same time, we looked at 39 major geopolitical events going back to World War II. The S&P, 3 months later, on average, these are the big ones, 9/11, JFK assassination, wars. The S&P was up, just barely, but up 3 months later. So we're by no means ignoring what's happening. But I think end of the day, if the economy is avoiding a recession, like we continue to think we will, you know, any of this near-term indigestion volatility probably is going to be more of an opportunity for a continued year-end rally.
On those major events, you always want to be a buyer long-term. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, on that indigestion, though, do you get a little bit of indigestion if the Fed does not cut rates at all this year, Ryan?
We don't think that's necessarily the case. First off, we do think there's probably still two cuts coming. We get into that, but we do. And again, what's going on? I mean, we are having historically strong productivity. The last three quarters of 3.7% annualized productivity. What's that tell us? In the mid-90s, we saw a lot of productivity, and the Fed was able to cut, and you didn't have this major spike in inflation. You had higher wages, but inflation was capped. So this game changer, if you will, is this strong productivity that we're seeing. And again, does the Fed really need rates at 5.5%? I mean, inflation's come back, and we can talk all day about this, right? The CPI worried everyone. The PPI was okay. The PCE is what the Fed watches. That's more in the middle. And of course, X shelter. Yes, the numbers are good. We get it. Shelter is that stubborn part, but we still think that the door is open for one or two cuts. And again, why is the Fed not cutting as much? Why have they punted when the first cut's going to be? Because the economy's strengthening. That's not always the end of the world.
Okay, I know you guys are technicians, you're technical analysts, but I got to talk about some fundamentals here because we have a huge week of earnings, Bill. Mm-hmm. We got Morgan Stanley tomorrow, United tomorrow. We had Goldman Sachs today, of course. We got Netflix later this week, Discover Financial, American Express, just to name a few. How important are these as catalysts for what the market does for the rest of the week, Bill?
It's very important. I mean, Morgan Stanley, we'll watch tomorrow, is hit on some news last week. We'll see if it does any bouncing. I'm looking at, you know, turning back to the charts, I'm looking at the Magnificent 7 Index. That's okay. Kind of my tell. It's still trading well above the 50-day moving average. So I'm looking at that for a tell in earnings. If that starts to roll over, then the market overall may continue to fade.
What do you think, Ryan? Is the Mag 7 Index an important one to watch and for earnings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at where the earnings growth this quarter is going to come from. A lot of it still is technology. What's interesting, though, is you go out 2-3 quarters, it's starting to spread out. You're starting to see more industrial potential strength, more financials earnings growth, and we expect that to happen as it's not just all about the Mag 7. And at the end of the day, also, you know, small and mid caps are interesting because 1 year out and 2 years out, there's a big jump in earnings growth and revenue growth in those areas. Now, I get it. Those are estimates. It doesn't mean it has to happen. But again, you look what happens historically when you have weak manufacturing surveys, the ISM, then it pops above 50 and starts to grow. 2-3 quarters later, small caps and mid caps tend to do much better. Why? Because it's probably an economy that's starting to emerge from some weakness. So I wouldn't say our economy is all that weak. We had a pretty strong economy last year, last I checked. But to see manufacturing coming back can be a tailwind for small and mid caps, which will probably be a good thing as the overall economy continues to grow and age, but still grow.
I'm looking at the RTY, the Russell 2000, that it dipped below what? Its 90-day moving average. Significant, Bill, to you?
I think so, but I have a question for Ryan regarding small caps. Yeah. We've been trading sideways for a long time now. What's going to be the catalyst or what's your target as far as breaking out if we do?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the Russell 2, it gained over 24% the last 2 months last year. That's a historic move. We took a look when you have, that was the second best 2 month rally ever, by the way. So the fact that it's, I mean, I think, you know, down a little bit, but flat-ish for the year, just kind of consolidating the first quarter of the year after that huge rally in the fourth quarter isn't overly concerning. Sure, we'd prefer to be up a little more, but it's not overly concerning. And I think to answer the specific question, it's going to be, we think there's going to be some more positive inflation prints coming. I get it. The last couple have been a little troublesome, but we think some better inflation data could be on the horizon, and that could open the door again, maybe for a cut or two, and that could be a one of the catalysts, along with the fact there's no recession coming, which is usually strong for the small and mid-names.
Ryan, last question, just got about 30 seconds. So from a technical perspective, which part of the equity market, be it sector, be it small cap, mid cap, large cap, seems the most interesting and appealing for investors right now?
Well, we've liked the cyclicals for a while, and I'll still say that. Your industrials, your financials, I mean, though materials, I mean, materials make up 3%, give or take, of the S&P, and there's a lot of strength coming from cyclicals. What's the message of the market, right? You mentioned real estate weak again today. Your staples have been weak, utilities weak-ish. So the message of the market to us is those offensive areas are still leading, and we still like them, especially if there's no recession this year, which we do not expect.
Two technicians have got along pretty well. What did you guys, like, talk beforehand? No sharing notes. Ryan Dietrich, thank you so much. Over at the Carson Group, joining us in studio, and of course, our own Bill Maloney. All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.